Hello, this is Belinda Rhodes with Guardian Daily. Today, Britain's charities are to be bailed out to the tune of £40 million as the economic downturn bites.
These charities need money because of donations partially drying up, also because demand for their services is higher during a recession.
Drug classification. We ask why the government is set to ignore more scientific advice on the risks of ecstasy.
The assessment of risk has very moral flavour to it, and I don't think it's like comparing the risk of crossing the road, driving down the motorway, or doing something else.
And an alternative thought for the day from secular contributor A.C. Grayling, kicking off a new series from Guardian Daily.
Regarding what people can choose, such as their political or religious commitments, say what you like. People must bear the consequences of their choices, including the disagreement, even the contempt of others.
But first, let's hear what's in the news headlines and have a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In the bushfires sweeping southern Australia, more than 120 people have been killed. The wildfires have burned whole towns to the ground in the state of Victoria. An area of 3,000 square kilometres has been affected. Survivors say the flames were raging as high as four-storey buildings and were sparking fresh fires as far as 20 miles ahead with the strong winds. Reports say 750 houses have been destroyed so far. Many survivors are in hospital. Though the chief reason for the intensity of the outbreak is the hot weather and drought, police believe that arsonists have also been deliberately starting fires. The Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd had this reaction.
What do you say? What do you say about anyone like that? What do you say? Don't know. Just, there's no words to describe it, other than it's mass murder.
The Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Here in Britain, ministers are going to announce a £40 million bailout for charities today. The Cabinet Secretary, Liam Byrne, said advice agencies and others were all facing increased demand because of the recession. Charities say they have had a severe drop in finances. We'll have the full story shortly in Guardian Daily. The BAFTA Awards last night, the film Slumdog Millionaire won seven gongs, including Best Film and Best Director for Danny Boyle. The actress Kate Winslet, who's won a double Golden Globe already, won the Best Actress Award in the BAFTAs as well for her performance in The Reader, where she plays a concentration camp guard. American actor Mickey Rourke won the Men's Award for his comeback part in The Wrestler. British performers have also done well at the Grammy Music Awards in Los Angeles. The Led Zeppelin frontman Robert Plant won Album of the Year for a collaboration with Alison Krauss, Raising Sand. The Song of the Year Award was won by Coldplay for their track Viva La Vida. Adele, Duffy, Radiohead and Peter Gabriel were also British winners. It's reported that Portsmouth Football Club are going to announce today that they've sacked their manager, Tony Adams. Adams has only been in the job for 3 months when Harry Redknapp left for Tottenham. The team have only won two matches since Adams took charge and lost 2-1 after a late goal to Liverpool on Saturday. Only The Sun managed to pick up that story for their early edition. They point out that only last week the Portsmouth management gave Adams an assurance of their support. Other papers focus on the strong win by Manchester United against West Ham and the fact that goalkeeper Van der Sar continues to increase his record of not letting in any goals. The Guardian gives cricket pride of place with admission by the England coaching staff that all their jobs are on the line after the team were defeated by an innings in the first test against the West Indies. On the front pages, the bonus for bankers is the most common choice of lead. The Guardian compares the small bailout for charities to the billions given to the banks. The Express is furious about the scandal of the £1 billion bankers' bonuses. The Telegraph says that ministers have told the banks cap bonuses or no more public cash. But the Times reports the bankers recruited to manage the government's bailout for the banks will themselves be paid bonuses. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The government is to bail out British charities to the tune of £40 million to help them through the economic crisis. Charities approached ministers 3 months ago, saying they would need £500 million to continue their work, and have since found themselves having to lay off staff in order to save services. The government says the assistance will be targeted so that charities involved in helping victims of the recession in particular will get the help they need. I asked our political correspondent, Allegra Stratton, for more on why the charities need this financial boost.
It seems like they've been laying people off, despite demands for their services going up almost 20%. Some of the big ones like Oxfam and Shelter and the NSPCC have been cutting staff, and a recent survey showed that a third of charities would lay off staff in the coming months. And it's partially thought to be because of a drying up of donations. The picture's quite unclear on this, because during recessions, actually, people don't stop giving, they just give in a different way. However, today, some charities have said that it is true. People are starting to give a little less. The NSPCC said they have a 2 million shortfall in their budget coming up. So these charities need money because of donations partially drying up, also because demand for their services is higher during a recession. They are on the front line of debt advice. For instance, something like Shelter is dealing with housing problems. But then there's this sort of interesting picture with something like Oxfam that's saying that actually its stores are making more of a profit at the moment because people are shunning more expensive brands, if you like, and going to shops like Oxfam. So it's quite an interesting picture. It is not the case that across the board they are struggling, but there are quite a few that do need money. They're often the smaller ones. 3 months ago they asked for 500 million. More recently they sort of scaled that down to 100 million. Today ministers have come back and said 40 million. I suppose, to be very uncharitable, no pun intended, you know, that's sort of millions, but banks have been getting in the order of billions. That the recapitalisation was 37 billion. Of course, there's a different argument with that, that the government are arguing they will at some point make money back on that, they will be able to make a profit. But nonetheless, some charities will be a bit disappointed.
And what about how the nitty-gritty of the world economy has affected them? I mean, did some of them, for example, have investments in Iceland? And what about the strength of the pound, or the weakness of the pound?
The Icelandic situation is interesting. I think that the saving, the underwriting of those savers who had money bound up in Iceland, the minister told me today that under that scheme, the charities were unlikely to lose out. But interestingly, Oxfam said that they, for instance, have really suffered from the devaluation of sterling, to the extent that in East Africa, they are very worried about one, their projects in that region. I think they've lost 500 million over there, to the extent that they're having to review all budgets.
And £40 million, as you say, is a drop in the ocean compared with some of the sums of money we've been hearing about in the news lately. So do you think it will be enough?
One senior figure in the charitable sector said that it's just the start. They'll be going back for more and more, and they'll probably get more and more as the recession continues over the next 18 months to a year. Ministers have hinted that there'll be further measures in months to come. Remember, we have the budget in late April. It's likely to be in late April, within which we might have announcements on things like further gift aid to encourage people to donate. £40 million is not very much money, but having said that, most people I spoke to today are their words are cautiously pleased.
Allegra Stratton there. And now, time for a new series in conjunction with Comment is Free. Another Thought for the Day is a secular take on the Today programme's long-standing Thought for the Day slot, but without the religious element. To kick off the series, here's the philosopher A.C. Grayling.
We've just had another spate of controversies over free speech, censorship and political correctness. This is a problem that keeps recurring in our society, and it needs clearing up. We need to give ourselves some general guidance on what we can say. The central point is that free speech is fundamental. Without it, we can't assert or defend other liberties and rights. We couldn't have democracy, which depends on debate and challenge. We couldn't have worthwhile education, which depends on exchanging information. We could only have formulaic literature and art. Without free speech, our lives would be as closed as our lips. But we know that for all its huge importance, free speech is not an absolute. It has to be responsibly used, given its potential for misuse. So, where's the line? In fact, it's not hard to draw. To speak insultingly or act discriminatorily with respect to other people's race, sex, sexuality, age, or disability is unacceptable. These are things over which individuals have no choice. Regarding what people can choose, such as their political or religious commitments, say what you like. People must bear the consequences of their choices, including the disagreement, even the contempt of others. Feeling offended is no defence against attack on your opinions by those who don't share them. Harsh things are often said in such debates, but here too there's a justification. Aristotle said that it's proper to express anger of the right kind in the right circumstances, for example, against injustice or cruelty. Of course, it would be better if disagreements were always peacefully debated, but that's to hope too much. So the rule is this: never asperse people for what they physically cannot help being. By all means, attack what they choose to think or be. But even here, it's better to attack ideas rather than individuals. Best of all, don't attack anyone for anything until you've given them a proper hearing. But if, having done so, you think they speak falsehood, folly, or malice, you shouldn't be afraid to say so as eloquently and determinedly as you can.
A.C. Grayling there, and you'll hear more alternative thoughts for the day this week and next week on Guardian Daily. And you can read more about the contributors and their thoughts at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Also on The Guardian's website today, for the latest news and pictures on the deadly bushfires in southeast Australia, go to guardian.co.uk/world. You'll find all the colour and glamour of the BAFTAs in words and pictures at guardian.co.uk/film. And to read how Manchester United reclaimed their spot at the top of the Premier League yesterday, go to guardian.co.uk/football. The government is expected to ignore calls this week to downgrade ecstasy from a Class A to a Class B drug. In the Class A bracket are drugs like heroin and crack cocaine. MPs asked the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs for a review on the health risks of ecstasy a year ago, and the council's report is due to come out on Wednesday. But as they did last month with cannabis, ministers will likely reject the advice. To find out why, I turn to our science correspondent Ian Sample.
Well, essentially, the committee that looks at these things, the Advisory Council, they look at all the scientific evidence for how dangerous or safe a drug is. And in this study, they looked at 4,000 papers. It took them a year. It's the most intensive review of scientific evidence that's ever been done for ecstasy. Now, that is the committee's job, is to put the scientific evidence forward to government. If government then decides as a political decision that it's not going to act on that advice, then that is up to them, really. And politicians do have one eye, obviously, on what the public are going to make of this, but they also have their own reasons. And I think with drugs, the assessment of risk comes with a very moral, has very moral flavour to it. And I don't think it's like comparing the risk of crossing the road, driving down the motorway, or doing something else.
Okay, well, the report isn't out yet, so we don't have the detail on what evidence the review found. But what can you say in broad terms about the health risks associated with ecstasy?
Well, the chair of this committee, a guy called David Nutt, down at Bristol University, has got a paper in press at the moment in which he actually compares the dangers of ecstasy taking as comparable to riding a horse. I mean, he's been looking at death rates, basically, with these sort of two things. And his argument is just that when compared with other things people do, ecstasy just isn't that dangerous. And he thinks that people by and large know that, and a lot of the scientific papers back that up. So this is essentially what we expect the committee to come out and say. Again, politicians will probably take a different view of that.
So then what is the point of the Advisory Council if the government is going to again ignore the advice?
Well, it's a question a lot of people have been asking, because you can imagine that people on this committee, they have taken an enormous amount of time to look over this, the evidence for harm caused by different drugs. And for them to then come out with their evidence and come out with a recommendation for government just to ignore it, and this is by no means the first time government has ignored them, makes you think, well, you know, is this system working? And people are openly questioning that now. But the chair of the committee says, well, look, our job is to review the science and say what we believe the case is on the basis of the science we know today. And as far as they're concerned, once they've done that, that is their job done. Their conclusion stands for everybody to look at, and it's watertight scientifically. They really believe that that is their job done. That is their role.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
I'm Belinda Rhodes. Still to come in Guardian Daily, how beauty salon tourism is boosting takings for Northern Ireland's hairdressers.
I would say a good maybe 300% increase in the salon. from what we had before with Southern clients.
But first, The Guardian's investigation into the arcane tax arrangements of many British companies continues this week. Many well-known businesses use complex offshore companies to minimise the amount of tax they pay to the UK Exchequer. Today on Guardian Daily, William Britton Catlin, who has written a book on how big business moved offshore, tells Matt Wells how the system developed in the mid-20th century.
After the Second World War, things really moved fast. There was a huge expansion in the spread of American capital, and that was done across Europe and other countries of the world rapidly in the 50s and 60s, and tax havens were absolutely key there for companies like Procter & Gamble and IBM to grow and expand across the world. So in that period, the post-war period, you get large multinational corporations getting larger and bigger, and they're doing that by going through tax havens and retaining their profits, which allows them then to spend more and keep the money offshore.
And all perfectly legally, of course.
All perfectly legally. At the same time, what happened in the 1960s was that the dollar escaped outside of the United States and went offshore. That meant that other countries were able to access US dollars offshore. And really the big player was the City of London. And the City of London effectively became a large offshore centre of its own. In fact, you could argue, maybe, as provocatively, that the whole of the UK itself has become one large offshore finance centre, linked in to all the other sort of classic tax havens and offshore finance centres out there. Why is that? I mean, look what happened in the early 80s with the liberalisation and deregulation of markets, is that finance became the big thing.
Why should people be concerned about that? It's a rather obscure subject, I suppose, for most voters when they're considering whom to vote for.
It's about justice. It's about tax justice. It's about paying the tax that is due from you to pay for the public goods that we'd like to take for granted in a civilised society. Quantifying it is very hard, and that's because of the fact of secrecy around the way that corporations account for their internal markets. So you do not know who owns things, how the money flows through the system, who it ends up in the hands of. It's all fragmented and all over the place, and that sort of utter complexity makes it impossible for revenues of the industrialized world to find out what's going on. But think about countries where things aren't so developed. They haven't got a cat's chance. Companies who are registered over here as headquarters, they get all the benefits of the political stability, the regulation. The courts over here are incredibly liberal in favour of corporations. So they're all come over here and register here and do their business here. But money's maybe not here, and the people who are running the companies maybe aren't here all the time. So they don't really know what it's like to be, living here onshore, living a kind of regular, ordinary kind of life, which is what the most of us do. And we're increasingly having to pay for that kind of avoidance. When you get a situation that's going on now where there is a financial collapse and we're having to bail out, the Exchequer's having to bail out banks and corporations, the risk accrues back onto us, then the losses are socialised onshore. Hmm. And we're in a situation now where if you were to go to Liechtenstein, a lovely little place, and go to the capital city of Vaduz, you would see across a vineyard at the foot of a nice alpine mountain, you'd see a bank that wouldn't look like a bank, looks a bit like a farmhouse. I've seen it myself, and it says Bank von Ernst on the side. You think, oh, that's rather nice. Then you do a bit of work and you find out, right, this is actually owned by the Royal Bank of Scotland. You know, how detached and offshore is that from, you know, the regular course of our lives?
Author William Britton Catlin talking to Matt Wells there, and you can read more on the tax investigation at guardian.co.uk/taxgap.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
Now, we've heard over the last few months about consumers from the Republic of Ireland travelling to Northern Ireland to do their shopping, benefiting massively from the strong euro. Well, now hair salons and beauticians are reporting a big increase in takings, as some clients from the south are travelling more than 100 miles north to have their hair done. And as The Observer's Henry MacDonald now reports from Belfast, they're saving quite large sums of money.
I'm here interviewing Andrew Mulvenna, who is the owner of one of the most successful hairdressing salons in Belfast. Andrew, an increasing phenomenon is, if you could call it, cross-border hairdressing tourism. Tell me about it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great advantage we have starting off this year. With the euro exchange rate, people are just finding it too attractive not to pass up. We've always had a good clientele coming up from the south anyway, thank goodness. But we've found really since before Christmas a fairly big increase, not just in terms of what we're doing with services, cutting, colouring and beauty services, but also our retail side of things. People are ringing up from the south asking how much our electrical products are, how much makeup is. We do some exclusive ranges like Shumur, which is Japanese, so which sells quite a bit more in Brown Thomas in Dublin, but here you can buy it at about 25% cheaper, really. So definite surge in it, you know. Thank goodness we're seeing the benefits of it. It's been great.
And I mean, what kind of volumes are you getting? I mean, are you getting sort of several ladies coming up as friends out for the day, that kind of thing, and wanting to save a few quid and at the same time have a bit of fun in the north?
Yeah, well, I think people are wrapping it in with a whole day out as well. You know, they're coming in, doing some shopping, and then wrapping this in with their day up to Northern Ireland, up to Belfast as well. I mean, I notice it not just in terms of people coming in, but when I do the books and I'm looking at the visa receipts, you're seeing euro exchange. So I sort of analyse it more in my office, really, to be honest. And, you know, I would say a good maybe 300%. Increase in the salon from what we had before with Southern clients.
Is that 300% over what time frame?
Really over the last sort of 2 months, to be honest. We've just opened up in the last sort of, well, 10-12 weeks. And it's really from that moment on, you know. Possibly it's to do with we've had a lot of impetus with publicity and publicity down south as well. So I think that has helped us, and the move to a bigger sort of Metro Spa has sort of given us the push too, and the sort of presence in the south of Ireland as well.
I mean, how much can a woman or a man, indeed, any of your clients save? Say, for example, compared to if they were to go and get a major treatment in Dublin.
Where we are, you're talking, you know, a set of foils and a cut would be about 180 euros. Here, it's 104, 105 pounds. So it's a saving of, you know, quite considerable amount of money. So it's very worth their while to do it, you know. So, and that's just one section. You add beauty services on top of that again, and then some retail. We had people ringing over Christmas in regard to, obviously, electrical GHD irons are very popular Christmas presents for women. Here they're £120 sterling for the special sort of gift set you would get. In Dublin they'd be nearly 200 euros. So, you know, the saving is huge. Some people were coming up and buying 6-7 pairs, and, you know, they weren't going to every single member in their family. They were probably having a little bit of a off the back of the car sales as well, just sort of pay for the petrol. So it's incredible, you know, it is incredible.
Henry MacDonald reporting from Belfast, and that's it from Guardian Daily today. The producers were Peter Sale and Tim Mabey. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thanks for listening.